Tony Fritton, Herzog and de Meuron, the Tate Gallery Modern from 2000. Art museums have always to address the relation between art and the public, and never more so when making a new building. Art consists of concentrated cultural intelligence expressed in ways that are often shockingly new, while public opinion is understandably committed to what is already known. Relations between these two have also to be accommodated to the political and social ideologies of the time. Even before an architect was selected, the Tate's freedom of location for a new building was conditioned by the prevailing ideological climate. Very soon after the Tate declared an intention to commission a new building in central London, the Bankside Power Station was announced as the new location. Although a work of historical significance by Giles Gilbert Scott, the Bankside building had been conspicuously protected from historical listing and made available by the government on an unavoidably advantageous terms. Its location in an uncontroversial margin of the city also allowed the usual arguments to be made for a cultural project to regenerate the surrounding district. Bankside Power Station was also old, although not as old as it looked, and therefore, in the British imagination, good. In the ideological microclimate of the British art world, old was good too, because this world was fearful of making what it saw as a European-style blunder with a new building, and old buildings were felt to have a kind of magic unavailable to the new. Public opinion was also on message through projects such as the Saatchi Gallery, which uses an industrial building in a posh district, and the depictions of glamorous lofts in the style sections of national newspapers. The selection of the architects, Herzog and de Meuron, in a well-organised competition between respected national and international architects was and remains a cause for celebration and optimism. Here was a practice that was relatively new to large-scale building, but able to command respect through the sheer confidence of their work, which was warmly regarded by many in the British architecture community, who felt that intelligent, courageous design would be made more possible by their working here. Herzog and de Meuron's directness in their proposals clearly appealed to the committee, who rejected Raphael Moneo's faith in the validity of architecture itself as basis for his very interesting and surreal distortion of the building. The highly cultured positions of Renzo Piano and Arata Isozaki, which are not easily transmitted in drawings, and Rem Koolhaas's powerful intellectual engagement with facts and circumstance. However, the real skill of Herzog and de Meuron's competition scheme was its appeal to the British art world mind through a combination of architectural artlessness and seemingly highly informed attitude to art. It is interesting to recall Tate director Nicholas Sirota's elegy for Max Gordon in the memorial that took place, rather ironically, between 6 and 8 at the Saatchi Gallery that Gordon had designed. Sirota spoke approvingly of Gordon's interventions to remove, quote, unnecessary items from Colquhoun and Millen's refurbishment of the Whitechapel Gallery, where Sirota was director at the time. What was evident in this elegy and the attitudes of Max Gordon himself, and among artists too, was a British instinctual mistrust of architecture. With their very developed ability to read a client, Herzog and de Meuron seemed to have understood this underlying condition and to have addressed it in the basic part with consummate skill. In their design, the relatively unmodified turbine hall presents itself as something between a warehouse and a city space, the escalators as purely a mechanical means of transport, and the galleries as functional spaces in which art can be properly viewed. In their more developed account of the architecture, the existing building was a precisely defined monument with a clear order and symmetries which they attacked without destabilizing it. cutting open the fabric for the entrance ramp and the adjacent cafe, and by this to change the meaning of the building as a whole without denying its origins. For this approach, they quote artist Joseph Beuys in saying that art, and in their terms, the building, should touch you but not explain. The Tate Gallery project team was lean at that time and able to participate creatively and decisively in the development of the scheme. Director Nicholas Sirota's skill and responsiveness was pivotal in the process of the selection of the architect, securing of funds and establishing optimistic public awareness. Herzog and de Meuron's experience of the construction management consultant to the Tate and collaborating architects was more problematic. From their account emerges a picture of those players being largely oblivious to the content of the scheme and only willing to deal with the project on their own established terms. It is worth comparing Herzog and de Meuron's account of their own working method, in which they are conscious of how they need to address the large-scale commissions they are drawing worldwide. They say that they recognise their naivete as an asset, which allows them to take a critical stance on each project while applying intense intelligence and work. At least one of the partners stays outside the day-to-day development of the project and is able to intervene critically to put the scheme back on track conceptually and architecturally. Consistent with their architectural party, Herzog and de Meuron's approach to construction in the face of the tight timetable, strict cost levels and procurement process at the Tate Modern was to use materials and techniques that are familiar to contractors, relate to the utilitarian quality of the existing building, which are simply detailed without being fetishized or minimalistic, and sometimes, as in the sawn floorboarding, are very compelling. The main entrance, with a street-level cafe at its side, ramps down from the ground level past a very large bookshop to the floor of the turbine hall, the enormous height of which is undivided except for two mezzanines. Its complete purposelessness, other than to be a place at the scale of the city, is admirable, and it sets up this scale throughout the rest of the building, which is divided into floors containing the galleries, interspersed sparingly with a bookshop and auditorium. Floors are connected by escalators within a space overlooking the turbine hall, and the galleries leading off from this space are configured as interconnecting rooms, several rooms deep, so that only some rooms have a window to the exterior and none have an opening wider than a door to the concourse side. However, the success in the relationship between the hanging of artworks, lighting, scale and proportion of the room and position of windows and escape doors throughout the galleries is variable. In the initial arrangement, a room with work by Beuys, for example, had the right kind of dignity and space to spend time with the work, while the room with Giacometti figures on the one hand and Barnett Newman paintings on the other did not allow enough space to see the work comfortably. The relatively small scale of the galleries frequently leads to their becoming a corridor under pressure from people entering rather than a place where a crowd can dwell. The quantity and arrangement of the work in the rooms played a part in this. Arranging the exhibitions by theme rather than by artist and date, here and at Tate Milbank, has been discussed at length by David Sylvester in the London Review of Books. It does not compare with the Hallen für Neukunst in Schaffhausen, which was also an industrial building and one much admired in the poll of artists taken by the Tate. Here the collection is disposed in small groups by individual artists linked visually to each other in very exciting ways. Screening and formation of rooms is very discriminate and well-scaled, so that a whole dark room of Bruce Nauman neon pieces or several bays of Robert Ryman paintings lit from the windows provide a great experience. Herzog and de Meuron's strategy of uniform fluorescent lighting that has long lamp life and requires no adjustment is understandable in a public gallery open 7 days a week. It is an approach that can be seen in commercial galleries in Basel and as evident in the bare fluorescence in the circulation areas, it appeals to the architect's pleasure in normative objects. It works where the ceiling is high and the light source is out of the viewer's cone of vision, but becomes intrusive when the ceiling is lower. In some situations, this has been offset with additional spotlights that brighten the overall view and make paintings such as those by Bridget Riley and Lichtenstein look good. But the system has problems when providing much lower light levels, as in the room containing some of Jasper John's finest prints, which were very hard to view. The lighting quality is also rather flat, which was very evident in the major Donald Judd retrospective. The problem lies in the adamant expression of the light source as a white glass screen, which Herzog and de Meuron presumably argued would become in time a normative object like the oversized cast iron air grills in the floor. A better lighting arrangement can be seen in Venturi Scott Brown extension to London's National Gallery. Small amounts of changing daylight, concealed fluorescence and spots are placed high up. Giving both conservation light levels and a sense of lightness and grace not matched in the Tate Modern. In the Tate, Herzog and de Meuron apply the illumination techniques of the galleries in the large lit forms of the concourse edge and the ceiling of the light bar on the roof. This effect is to make it very difficult for the eye to accommodate darker parts of the view, in particular the view out over the city. Here and in the overscaled information desks and seating, and the ubiquitous colour black, naivete combined with supreme confidence does not seem to have paid off. In Herzog and de Meuron's apartment building in Schützenmattstrasse in Basel, there is perceptive handling of the form and detailing in the ground floor of the new building in relation to an exposed existing party wall opposite, culminating in a convincing and contemporary experience of space. Some of this quality exists in the areas each side of the bookshop on the upper level that leads to the outside balconies high up on the building. It is possible that during the next few quarterly rehangs intended by the Tate, that the lighting and the display will be refined, and some rooms and their relationships to each other and to the windows on the exterior will be altered. In the meantime, it will be a huge and increasing public success and become a key component among the places for culture and relaxation in the city. In an informal discussion with Harm Tilman, the deputy editor of the Netherlands architectural magazine De Architect, I was critical of another recently completed art museum in central London. Why, he asked, did I not debate this publicly with the authors of the scheme, as Rem Koolhaas does with Hermann Herzberger? In his view, this would be absolutely normal practice, given that architecture and planning is openly and publicly debated in the Netherlands, and city commissioners and gallery directors are frequently active in the schools of architecture. It was painful to describe the resistance to creative discussion here and the defensiveness that it causes in architects and clients who attempt to make good work. Britain is now some way into a period of economic prosperity, and the possibility of a more qualitative attitude to architecture and planning is conceivable through the effective agencies such as CABE, Commission for Architecture and the Built Environment. For this to give lasting benefit, you would hope for a considered and intelligent discourse, focusing not on how architecture fails or how it can palliate the uninformed urges of developers, politicians, and populists, but what it takes for a cultural institution to really and truly succeed.